Good morning. Oh, the sound of conversation. School holidays is always a funny time. It's way, way more empty seats, but it's great. It's good to be gathered. It looks like Banks has left me a little bit of a mid-sermon snack. Thanks, buddy. Oh, better than last week. I think my voice is finally back, so we'll get through this, hopefully. Hey, we're kicking off a new preaching focus this morning, basically for the whole of the third quarter. So hopefully you would have seen online, we had a post go up. If you don't follow us on whatever those things are, Facebook and Instagram, jump on and stay up to date with a few different things. But we're jumping into this preaching focus called Ancient Paths and Timeless Truths, looking at a whole bunch of different figures of faith from the Old Testament for the whole of this quarter. I'll get to a little bit more detail on that a little bit later on this morning. But there's going to be a big diverse range of voices in the midst of this. All of the ministry interns are going to be preaching different weeks throughout this preaching focus. I'm trying to get a mate in who's got a really great message on King Josiah and trying to line up those dates and whatever else. But we're going to go on a journey through the Old Testament. We spend so much time in the New Testament, I think rightly so, but there is such a depth of story and experience and practicality found in the Old Testament, particularly these figures of faith. So we're going to look at their lives. We're going to look at the journeys that they had with God and see how that interacts with what it looks like to follow Jesus today. But I want to put to us this morning, Pastor Liam sends his love, by the way, and Phoebe, they're taking a well-deserved Sunday off this week. He'll be back around next week, but they're enjoying some time off. But he wanted me to let everybody know that they're missing us, but they're also enjoying their time away. And so we'll see them next week. But I want to put to us, while I'm sure this is not new, I find myself at different points over the last couple of years, I think somewhat unsettled at the pace of the world and the way that culture is changing so rapidly. I know that there's been multiple times over the course of the last couple of years where I'll jump on social media and see some post from somebody in the world, something that's trending or going viral where, that's what truth is now. Sure, that's how we're labeling this now. This is what popular culture is saying about this issue or this issue. And there's these moments that I've had where it feels like the ground that we stand on is constantly shifting. Things are moving morally, spiritually, culturally. There's just this constant shifting and ebbing and flowing and changing of what we're saying is truth, what it is to be human, and so on and so forth. It feels like these values that were once foundational to the way that we lived life, to these values that shaped culture and our normal lived experience as humans, are becoming more and more negotiable as time goes on. And at worst, are just being completely disregarded as irrelevant or just not truth anymore. There's this sense that I've had over the last couple of years, maybe you've been in the same boat, where it feels like truth is being treated as this thing that's increasingly subjective, that conviction and challenge and dying on particular hills is becoming more and more offensive to different people. And that in many ways, this idea of faith, of religion, of following Jesus in particular, for many, is being seen as optional, if not completely irrelevant. We live in a time where many different cultural commentators and theologians and different voices in the Christian world have started to label this moment that we live in as almost entirely post-Christian. Some have even labeled it, our context, as a modern-day Babylon, if you will, which we'll get to a little bit in a minute. There was one point a few years ago where a couple of different cultural commentators over in the United States, so prevalent has this rise in pushing back on religion and following Jesus. So prevalent was this increase in this people group called the nuns. And this is a group of people who effectively, what was described as functional atheism. And so it was this idea that no longer was there this fierce opposition to following Jesus, or people that were passionate atheists, but this group of people called the nuns, who they became so indifferent to Jesus and to God that they wouldn't even be classed as atheists. They're just nothing. They hold to nothing. They believe in nothing. There is nothing to their worldview. And at one point a few years ago, they were the fastest growing religious group in the world. This group of people identifying as nuns and not the Catholic kind. just to clarify. There's this sense, I think, across culture in many ways that this indifference seems to be the prevailing mood of our day. And I think the question for us as we seek to follow Jesus in this context is, how do we stay faithful to God? How do we stay faithful to following Jesus when everything around us is pushing us and pressing us towards drift or drifting further away from Him? How do we stand firm in our convictions without becoming combative to the culture around us? How do we stay engaged with the world around us without being shaped by it? How do we raise children, lead churches, serve communities, and seek to walk faithfully, glorifying Jesus in all we do in the midst of a culture that is less and less likely to recognize Him? And while I know these aren't new questions, they've been asked before by figures of faith who have walked these ancient paths before us. People like Abraham, Deborah, Elijah, Ruth, Esther, Moses, and this morning we look at Daniel in the book of Daniel. And this whole preaching focus, ancient paths, timeless truths, it's an invitation, I think, for us to learn from these faithful ones who have gone before us. These men and women who've walked with God in uncertain times. And while their worlds were absolutely different and culturally and contextually, a lot has changed. Our God hasn't. Our God has stayed the same. And I think their stories, they carry truths for us that we need now more than ever as we seek to faithfully follow Jesus. And so today we begin with Daniel. This is a young man who knew what it was to live as a faithful follower of God in the midst of a world, a culture, and a context that did not share his values. The story that we look at, his story, it begins not in strength, but in exile, begins in the context of hostility and even persecution. Jerusalem, his home city, has been overthrown by the Babylonian army. The temple of God destroyed. It's more than likely that his own family have been killed by the Babylonian army in the midst of this invasion. He's living now as a captive, dragged to the city of Babylon, this powerful empire that is ultimately built on idolatry and pride. It goes against everything that he's grown up with and knows and understands. In the midst of this context, they even change his name from Daniel, which means God is my judge. And they give him a name that's relevant to a Babylonian god, rubbing insult into injury. He's trained in Babylonian culture. He gets educated in their ways, in their thinking, and in their language. And it's more than likely, we don't know for sure, but it's more than likely that he was made a eunuch in his service of King Nebuchadnezzar and later on King Darius, so that there was no possible distractions for him. The Babylonians have taken away the opportunity for him to have any kind of future legacy and any future family lineage. This is a teenage boy, traumatized and displaced, now expected to serve the very empire that's destroyed everything he knew. And more so, he finds himself serving in the courts of the king who ordered and oversaw it all. And I think it's worth pointing out at this point that this is not a precursor to a Christian success story waiting to happen. This is a story of crisis, it's a story of wilderness, and it's a story of exile. And yet, in the middle of this cultural pressure cooker that is Babylon, Daniel doesn't lose his faith. If anything, he relies on it and he goes deeper in his faithfulness to God. He doesn't hide his convictions. Instead, he lives them out with absolute strength and courage. He doesn't blend in or conform to the culture around him. Instead, he stands out and he stands up on multiple occasions. And I think here's what we need to catch from the very beginning this morning. Daniel's reward wasn't the influence that he eventually gains in Babylon. His reward was the faithfulness that he maintained. And I have to preface at this point, I've preached on Daniel's life before. And I'm honestly a little bit embarrassed to say that if I dwindled that message down to one sentence, it was effectively, if we stay faithful to God, then God's going to be faithful to promote us to positions of influence. And while to an extent that is Daniel's story, that reflection and that perspective on when I preached this before, probably honestly came from an unsanctified part of my own ego that was chasing platform and chasing influence and chasing significance. And so my prayer all week in preparing this has been that as we lean in this morning, that this would be a more honest, mature reflection of Daniel's experience and story in Babylon, where the reward was not influence, the reward was faithfulness itself. He doesn't posture himself for influence or for power. He simply postures himself to continue to serve his faithful God. And I want to put to us that posture really matters. You know, I've reflected before that in a previous life, running my own personal training business and training clients, that you encounter different things in people's bodies as different goals and different outcomes that people are desiring from training. But one thing that was just unanimous across the board was the relevance of posture. No matter the goal, no matter the outcome that people were chasing, posture mattered. We could address different muscle imbalances, we could address weight loss issues and so on and so forth, but the reality of sitting at a desk all day, getting tight hips and tight hamstrings, hunching over is just not good for the body. And we can't outwork poor posture. And when we're talking about posture this morning, I'm not just talking about physical posture. Things get out of alignment and out of whack when our physical posture is not good. It's important. Ask anyone with back issues. Poor posture can affect everything: our sleep, our breathing, our energy, and our mood. Poor posture ultimately throws things out of alignment. But I think the same is true spiritually. If our hearts are slouched over, if our spiritual cores are weak, if our convictions hunch over at the first sign of cultural pressure, reality is, I think, things in the context of the church and our lives get out of alignment. That's why as we seek to explore Daniel's life this morning, the language and the imagery of posture is going to give some shape to things. We want good, healthy posture, physically and spiritually. There's a timeless truth, or timeless truths, I think, found in Daniel's spiritual posture. He aligned himself before God, and when pressure came, he remained faithful. And there's three postures that we're going to look at this morning that mark Daniel's life. There was a posture of surrender, that he stayed aligned to God's ways even when it cost him. He had a posture of faith, that he chose confidence in God over fear of man and serving man. And he lived with a posture of prayer. He lived from a secret place, not seeking spotlight or influence or platform, but more than happy to kneel before God three times a day and pray. I want to put to us that these ancient postures, while incredibly simple and I'm sure are familiar to us in some capacity, they're not outdated. They're timeless truths that are vital as we seek to contend, as we seek to live in the midst of our own modern day Babylon. Would you join me in prayer before we lean in further? Lord, thank you that you are absolutely in our midst this morning. God, we've had the chance to honor you through worship, to declare that you truly are the only one who is holy and worthy. We've joined with the chorus of angels this morning that have been singing that song for all of history. And as we open your word now, Jesus, I pray as the living word that you would embody our time together. That as we read your word, God, as always, I pray that it would read us, that it would refine us, it would shape us. And that, God, you would reposture us as we seek to follow you and serve you faithfully in the midst of this cultural moment and context that we live in. God, would all we do this morning honor you and glorify you. You continue to seek you for your leadership, your wisdom, and your guidance. Thank you for your presence with us this morning. Amen. Posture of surrender. This is the first glimpse that we get of Daniel's life right in the first chapter, Daniel 1. Contextually, Babylon's conquered Jerusalem at this point. The temple's been raided. This group of people have been exiled. And there's a particular prophecy out of the book of Jeremiah here that Daniel would have been aware of. This exile was prophesied. Daniel would know at this point, even as a young teenage boy, that this is not going to be a short-lived experience. Jeremiah prophesied 70 years of exile. This is what Daniel knows he's about to live out. He's still a teenager. And at this point in Daniel 1, he's handpicked along with other promising young men to serve in King Nebuchadnezzar's court. This is a place of proximity and closeness to this king. They're bought into this effectively 3-year training apprenticeship program. They're taught the language and the literature of the Babylonians. They're given new names. And crucially, they're offered food and wine from the king's own table. And at this point, one could be forgiven, I think, for thinking that this is a position of favor. To be living in the place of exile, to be having to contend with all that you've left behind and finding yourself with food from the king's own table, serving in his courts, no doubt experiencing some level of favor. Some would see this as a privilege and absolutely as a chance to survive in the midst of chaos. But really interestingly, in verse 8, we read that Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Immediately, he draws a line in the sand. And this is about more than the food itself. This is about what the food represents. Contextually, food from the king's table in Babylon would have been dedicated to Babylonian idols. It would have been prepared in violation of Jewish dietary laws. And in some sense, it was arguably symbolic of full cultural assimilation. To eat it, in a sense, would have been to fully consume the culture of Babylon and to start letting the culture and the context that he was in form him. And so Daniel says no. And I think this is a significant point where he draws the line. He's willing to learn the language. He's willing to study Babylonian literature. He's even willing to serve in the king's palace and be at the king's service, but he's not willing to eat the food. And I want to put to us that this was not about rebellion, but it was about consecration. That this was a decision for Daniel to remain set apart, even in the midst of exile, even when no one else would know. His posture at this point, in some sense, is I'll live here, I'll serve here, but I won't become like here. He couldn't be influenced ultimately by the ways of one kingdom because he was already living surrendered to the ways of another. And I think this raises a question for us. What is the food of our cultural moment? What are we being served every day by the culture around us? While we might not contextually be in Babylon itself, we're absolutely immersed in a culture with its own menu. A smorgasbord of curated ideas and values and stories and behaviors that we've already reflected on repeatedly this year that have the potential to form us. And if we're not discerning, we will end up being casual in our consumption. Maybe for some of us, it's that we're eating of the food that is choosing self over surrender, that we've bought into the lie that we can live our own truth, that we can do whatever feels right, that we can pursue our own agenda and ourselves above all others. But Jesus calls us to lay down our lives, to take up our cross and to lose ourselves, to lose our lives in order to ultimately find them. Maybe it's that we're buying in or we're consuming the reality of distraction over devotion, that we binge, we scroll, we consume content endlessly, often without asking how it's forming us, whether it's making us more like Jesus or less. Maybe it's that we're eating of the food, the snack of choosing comfort over conviction, that where culture says avoid pain, avoid hard conversations, avoid any kind of pressure. But this gospel that we believe in and that we buy into and that we seek to live by, it was never meant to be an invitation to a comfortable life. It's an invitation to a transformed life, and transformation hurts sometimes. Maybe it's that we're eating of the food, that we're choosing image over integrity, that we've been discipled to perform for this algorithm, to curate all of the visible things of our lives, even when we're living empty on the inside. And just like the king's food, some of these things might have looked delicious. Maybe there's some source of life that we find in them in the short term. What we're being offered maybe ultimately has some sense of appeal. But just because it's served to us doesn't mean we're meant to eat it. And I think Daniel models something incredibly countercultural in this moment. He is willing to engage in Babylon, but he will not become like Babylon. And that is the call for us too. We do not need to buy into the lie that we have to look like Babylon to reach Babylon. We don't need to sound like everyone else to have a voice, and we don't need to compromise our distinctiveness for the sake of impact. This posture of surrender that Daniel lives by, that I think we should be buying into as well, is about saying that our lives are not ours to shape, and neither is whatever popular culture dishes up what we want to shape us. It's about saying that my appetite and the appetites of the world don't lead me. Ultimately, Jesus does. We continue. Daniel finds himself, I think, living with this posture of faith. We've already seen him resolve not to defile himself with food from the king's table. He chooses consecration over compromise. And this was a private, personal, owned decision. Ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, it takes place in the context of a simple, small, quiet conversation with one of the king's guards. But as we continue into Daniel 2, we see that the fruit of what this kind of inner life produces when crisis hits. In Daniel 2, King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. It's so disturbing that it keeps him up all night. And he demands that his astrologers, his magicians, and the people that he consults for wisdom not only interpret the dream, but first tell him what the dream actually was. He offers no insight, no clues, and no details. He simply says, "Tell me what I dreamed and what it means, or I will have you torn limb from limb." His royal advisors, I think rightfully so, they're stunned at this point. They respond, "No one on earth can do what the king asks." And they're right. Except we continue to read into Daniel 2 that there is someone, not because of who he is, but because of who he belongs to. Daniel catches wind of what's going on and he responds to the king, not with panic, not with a sense of self-preservation, but with prayer. And I'm always struck by this as I reflect on the life of Daniel. I think the text makes it at least appear at this point that there is no hesitation in Daniel at this point. He immediately goes to a group of his friends, other exiles, and he gathers them to pray. He doesn't stall, he doesn't flinch, and he doesn't live in doubt. This is an impossible task. He simply does what we can only assume he has done countless times before. He prays, he fasts, and he seeks God. And I was struck again this week. What kind of history did this teenage boy have with God that he would carry this sense of conviction in this moment? This is not a seasoned ministry veteran. This is not a senior pastor or somebody who's been following Jesus for 50, 60 years. This is a teenage boy who's developed some kind of history with God. And I want to put to us that this kind of boldness in public doesn't come from having a shallow faith in private. This is the kind of unshakable faith and confidence that is forged over years of walking with God when no one is watching, where others around him would say, "No one on earth can do this." Daniel says, "There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries." And I think here's what makes this moment even more stunning. Upon praying, upon fasting, and upon getting an interpretation of this dream from God, Daniel doesn't seize this moment to big note himself. He doesn't take the credit, and he doesn't posture himself as impressive or extraordinary. Instead, he stands before the most powerful man on the planet at the time, and he says, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery. But there is a God in heaven." What a moment. Daniel's still living in exile and captivity at this point. He could have used this moment to reduce his own suffering, could have taken the opportunity to elevate his own status with the king. But instead of pointing to himself, he points beyond the king's palace, he points beyond the king's throne, and he points beyond the king's empire. And instead, he points to a greater throne and a greater kingdom with a greater king. I think to say that in private, or to resolve to have that attitude and that posture in the privacy of our own lives, is one thing. But to stand in front of the man who literally holds your life in his hands and declare to him that there is a God in heaven who is greater than you, I think is another level of faith. This is a declaration that there is one more powerful than the king, and that that is who Daniel serves. I think to an extent there's a precursor here to what Paul would write in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, when he says, "My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power." Daniel shows us, I think, what it looks like long before Paul penned those words. But let's be honest of our own cultural moment at this point. We live in a culture with a lot of confidence in human wisdom. We believe technology can solve almost anything, and in many ways it feels like it can. We look to self-help and psychology and strategies to manage our lives, which are not inherently wrong. We put enormous trust in politics, in economics, and in these cultural narratives to shape the security of our future. And while many of those things have their place, and it's just the reality of the time that we live in, they cannot answer the deep spiritual ache of the human heart. At some point, we will all face things that human wisdom cannot fix. And I think this is where the posture of faith becomes vital. And Daniel shows us that we don't need to be in a position of power to walk in authority. Daniel's spiritual authority isn't based on his platform or his social standing. It's based on his posture of faith. And I think this is where we as a church, we need to rise not with arrogance, but with holy confidence. Not making much of ourselves, but saying with clear and humble faith, there is a God in heaven. And he still works, and he still moves, and he still ministers in power today. The final posture of prayer. By the time we're jumping ahead a little bit here, but by the time we reach Daniel 6, Daniel is no longer a teenager. Years have passed. He's not this fresh-faced exile from chapter 1 or the young interpreter from chapter 2. He's now a seasoned trusted leader in the context of Babylon. He finds himself distinguished above all other administrators in the empire. He's found favor not just with King Nebuchadnezzar, but with the new king, King Darius. And Daniel finds himself in this position where he's about to be promoted to a new role where he would be overseeing different aspects in the entire kingdom of Babylon. But his integrity and his favor, it draws jealousy. There's other officials, they can't find any grounds to accuse him. His character has stood the test of time. And so they go after the one thing they know that he won't compromise on, his faith. They convince King Darius to issue a decree that for the next 30 days, no one can pray to any god or person except King Darius himself. And if they do, they will be thrown into the lion's den. It's clearly a trap. And it's clearly targeted directly at Daniel. And I think at this point, this is just a random reflection. What would it look like for us to live the kind of lives where the only way that we could get caught out in a trap is with our own integrity and our own character? That Daniel lives so holy and pure in the context of exile, the only way that they can find fault in him is because his character is so pure and so true. Oh, may we live lives like that. This is where we pick up in Daniel 6:10. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. Let's not rush past this final phrase, just as he had done before. Crisis did not create Daniel's prayer life. It revealed it. This was not a moment of panicked prayer. This was a moment of patterned prayer, a rhythm and a path that Daniel had walked for years before this moment. He's not running to prayer as a last resort. He simply keeps walking the well-worn path that he has walked for decades. His life, almost in a sense, has these grooves of prayer carved into it. And so when pressure comes, he doesn't need to to find a new response. He just stays faithful to what he already knows. He hears the law, he knows the cost, but still, he goes home, he opens the windows, and he kneels down 3 times a day, just like always. I want to put to us, I don't think he's making a point. I don't think he's adopting a posture of protest to this decree. I think he's simply just doing this because this is who he was. And this is the key. We reflect on Daniel's moment in the lion's den, and I'd put to us this morning that he doesn't find his courage in the lion's den. He found it in that moment in his upper room as he postures himself in the place of prayer. He knows the consequences of what he's about to do, and he does it anyway, 3 times a day, every day. He's built a rhythm to this point, a habit, and his life has been shaped by this posture. This is the secret place that has shaped his public faith. And I'm sure it's not news to any of us that we live in a loud culture. It's reactive, it's distracted, and there is constantly stuff in our face. And even though I don't have that many years of life to call on, life has taught me to this point, over a decade in ministry, that often our loudest witness actually begins in our quietest moments. And our visible growth is prepared in our unseen places. The world may never see our prayer life or our prayer closet or our prayer moment, but if we're faithful in that rhythm, it will absolutely feel its impact. This posture of prayer, it's not about how long we pray for. It's not about how eloquent we sound. Jesus had a lot to say about that. But it's about priority. It's about dependence. And it's about rhythm. It's about saying, I need God more than I need control. It's about saying, I need to hear from heaven more than I need a scroll for answers. And it's about saying, I need to seek his face before I seek any outcome or any kind of result. Regardless of what our posture of prayer looks like this morning, maybe it's regular, maybe it's intermittent, maybe we're frustrated about it, the invitation is the same. The call of God in every season for every follower of Jesus is to kneel before the open window. Because we will not stand strong in the lion's den if we have not first knelt before him in the secret place. Daniel's posture of prayer, it sustains him through times of favor, through crisis, through betrayal, and through times of pressure. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that that same posture will sustain us too. Posture matters. Daniel didn't rise to influence because he sought it. He doesn't survive his time in exile because he figured out how to play the game. He wasn't rewarded because he assimilated or became more Babylonian. Instead, he was faithful. He was surrendered to God. He trusted God. He walked with God. And he never let go of the postures that held him through it all. His posture of surrender, his posture of faith, his posture of prayer. These things shaped his life. And the same has to be true for us. We live in this time where the pressure to be relevant is louder than ever. The call for sharper branding, for better programs, for shorter sermons, apologies in advance already, I'm over time, for slicker gatherings, to not be too intense, to maybe not be too passionate, and then at other times to not be too challenging, then to not be too soft. But here's the tension. I think somewhere along the way, we've become guilty of thinking that the fruit of the church is going to be found in our relevancy. But I want to put to us that it's actually found in our reverence. The world does not need a church that mirrors culture. It needs a church that mirrors heaven. And when we look through history, we see this pattern again and again. The church of Jesus Christ ultimately loses its power when it trades its distinction for cultural compromise. The demise of the church in popular culture has often come as we've sought to be popular in culture. But the reality is this, we were not called to blend in. We weren't called to be impressive. We've simply just been called to be faithful. Worship team, this is probably a good point, I think. I'm a little bit excited. Thank you so much. Daniel ultimately doesn't gain influence because he makes peace with this season of exile in Babylon. He gained influence because he walked with God in Babylon, because he chose the ultimate posture of faithfulness to God. And I don't know, maybe we need to be reminded again today that the power of this gospel that we believe in has never been in its popularity. It's always been in its author. Jesus doesn't go to the cross to win over a crowd. He goes to the cross to save the world. And the reality of this message is still the same. It's still hope for the hurting. It's still grace for the sinner. It's still power for the weary. And it is still salvation for the lost. And that truth does not change with culture. And that kind of love does not weaken over time. Our posture still matters. And so as we reflect this morning and hopefully over the course of the next week, I think the challenge for us is this. It's the reflection again that our posture matters. Our posture as a church matters. Our posture, the posture of our hearts matters. The posture of our lives truly matters. That we would live as these surrendered, faith-filled people, deeply rooted in prayer. Because I'll say it again, the world that is hurting and broken does not need a church that looks more like culture. It needs a church that looks more like heaven. And the world does not need more people who look like them. It needs more people who look like Jesus. And we won't achieve those things, and they won't be built in our midst unless we're postured appropriately and towards help. Would you pray with me? God, I'd ask you this morning for a grace, for an ease, and for a supernatural power over us as your people. Really for your whole church in this city, a grace to pray. God, a comfort to call on your name and to declare, even in the midst of our own version of Babylon, that there is a God in heaven. That God, you would posture us in surrender. And then the cry of our heart ultimately, the loudest cry, is that we would seek to be faithful to you. And that as we do so, God, you would do what you need to in our midst. God, that you'd lead us where you need to lead us, that we would be open and surrendered. God, that we'd be postured to find ourselves aligned with you and your wills and your way. God, lead us again this morning. As we enter into this season, this journey, reflecting on these figures of faith that followed you, not perfectly, but faithfully. But I pray you use this time as a catalytic moment for us as a community. We'd see Daniels rising up, and we'd see Esther's and Ruth's. God, that we'd see Abraham-like character and obedience. God, that we'd see people with vision to build like Nehemiah. God, that you do a work in our midst, that we would adopt a value for your presence and a passion for your calling like Moses. And that God, as we look around, that you just be calling out different things in our midst and different things in our lives. That more glory would come to you in your name, and that more glory would come to your church. More honor would come to your church, God, and more help would come to our community here as we seek to faithfully follow you. God, we worship you this morning. Lead us again as we seek to honor you.